This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Ian Ryan is an Australian writer who grew up in Brisbane but now lives in Melbourne with his family. A crime writer, he is the author of 4 Days and The Student, both shortlisted for the Ned Kelly Award. His work has been previously published by, I've just realised I cannot pronounce that, Ian, help me out, Akashic?
Oh, Akashic, yeah.
Akashic Books Online, Crime Factory, Kill Your Darlings, and Seizure. Ryan's latest book is The Spiral, published in 2020 by Echo here in Australia and Bonnier in the UK. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Ian.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Kate.
Look, I'm going to be really frank, straight up, in that I asked you to do this interview in the festival afterglow of us being roommates at Margaret River, and we had some long drives and some late nights together, and I was pretty sold on some of your excellent stories. And I went on to really actually talk you up as soon as I got back on the podcast. So I just want to say up front, no pressure.
I was going to say, do you regret it now? Like, is it the afterglow?
Well, I don't regret it yet. I don't regret it yet. But the afterglow does fade, huh? Did you have that experience?
Oh, yeah. I felt terrible. Yeah. I was like, I felt like a millionaire. And then I came back and I'm like, no, you're just some asshole.
It's okay. We'll get some of the glow back today. You are a fan of Choose Your Own Adventures, and you're a little bit unexpected just in general. So I'm not going to start where I usually start.
Sure.
I'm going to keep you on your toes. One of the first things that you said to me, and it blew my mind a little bit on the long road from Perth to Margaret River, which actually wasn't meant to be as long as it was. Really, we took the long route.
Yeah, that's Chris Flynn.
That was Chris Flynn's fault. But you said something like, oh, yeah, but then I learned about the only two scenes after the reveal rule, and so I rewrote that. And I said, Ian, what rule? And you said, you know, the rules of crime writing. And there, mind blown. So can you please explain that rule to us?
Yeah, it's 2 to 3 scenes. And look, Angela Meyer taught me this. So this may have been something that she made up. Maybe this is a complete lie too, that she just said to me to get me to cut the end of The Student, which my wonderful second novel that that had a long outro that got really sort of tapered back in the editing. But yeah, Angela Meyer told me that after the big reveal, like there's always a big climax, you know, in the old golden age mysteries, this is when Hercules Poirot says, oh, you're the killer. And, you know, in modern crime fiction, there's a shootout or a, you know, like a big apex moment there where the killer is revealed or, you know, the secret is revealed. And she said to me, after that point, you're allowed 2 to 3 scenes. That's it. That's the end. It's got to all end. Yeah, after that. I don't want anything else other than 2 to 3 scenes, which is very challenging for me, but made for, I think, quite a good end to the book. Both books, in fact.
Yeah, both books have excellent endings. Are there any other rules that we should know about?
you know, like, well, one of them, the most obvious or, like, famous crime writing rule is that the body is on the first page. And
Hang on, because I'm not a crime writer. Say it again. The body.
Yeah.
Is on the first page.
Yeah, so the, you know, in a real straightforward down the line procedural, police procedural or a detective procedural, the crime scene and the body will be on the first page, essentially.
Yeah,
so
okay,
the scene will open up and that, you know, you're right in that the inciting incident is page one, essentially, of the crime novel. And to a degree, I have done that at different times. Like, it's in The Student, it's just really carefully submerged. Like, the Mayor Kibbe mention is like right on the first page, but then I sort of tool around with like who is the body, I suppose, in The Student. So, you know, but I'm playing against the rule, like, but the rule still stands.
Yeah, so I want to ask you about that idea of rules and genre, because you describe your genre as hard-boiled noir. Now, I'm not a crime writing expert. I don't really understand all the different definitions within it. Certainly The Student and The Spiral are not like any other books that I've read before. what do you say defines your genre or your anti-genre or whatever it is that you're doing, Ian?
Noir is like one of those horrendously contested terms within crime fiction circles. And, you know, Andrew Netty once said to me that the easiest way to know whether you're a noir writer is if someone else calls you that.
Okay.
And it got mentioned quite a lot in the earlier reviews, so I sort of went with it. But my general interpretation of it is that it's crime fiction that has a downbeat ending or a lot more complexity around the state of the world. In a straightforward police procedural or like a CSI Miami or something, there's a rupture at the beginning where a crime happens and then it's sort of the world is neatly put back together. Like it's a story about the redemption of like law and order almost. A lot more nuance than that in good crime fiction, I would argue, but that's the general idea. With noir, there's a sense that the protagonist learns that the world is like a complex and broken kind of place and that it's not altogether put back in the right way by the end. Like it's sort of left hanging a little bit. Like, you know, famous noir films are like easy to get a hold of, things like Chinatown, LA Confidential. That's the sort of area that I'm interested in. It's much more character focused too than, it's slightly less procedural and more character focused.
So you also say that you like to push back against the rules. I can see in terms of the spiral where you've whacked a bloody choose your own adventure into the middle of it, that is one way that you are pushing back against them. Did you kind of have your grounding? Did you grow up reading straight crime? Is that what you always knew you wanted to write?
No. See, this is where it gets, I mean, I grew up as a teenager in the 90s. And in crime fiction had this real moment in the 90s, like a pop culture moment after, I think I came into it through Pulp Fiction, the film, and then...
One can see some influences in your work.
Yeah. The interest in violence definitely comes from that moment. It was a very violent moment in terms of film in particular. But then, you know, that came around and in the 90s there was a lot of crossover between crime fiction and music and grunge culture and alternate culture and all this sort of stuff. So I was reading about crime fiction in places like in music magazines, essentially. And James Ellroy, you know, the don of American crime writing, you know, he tours Australia around that time and he, you know, he's playing to 1,000 people and things like that. He's like absolutely ginormous. And that moment is like really brief, of course. It lasts a couple of years. It's off the back of all these other like much more commercial crime fiction authors, as often is the way. And so I was, you know, my idea of what a crime novel was really early was actually quite left of center. But then I still, you know, as you often do, you get on in life and you decide you're going to write a novel. You go back to the stuff that you love as a kid. That's what I did anyway. I wanted to sort of reconnect with that exciting aspect of reading, I suppose.
And how did you look at those novels? And I've heard you talk about the beats in novels or in crime fiction before. Did you look at them and say, okay, this is how I'm going to put something together? Or are you more of a pantser kind of guy? Like, okay, I'm going to follow this character into their violent, crazy mind and world.
I'm much more careful and I outline my novels before I write them. So I'm not a pantser at all. And it's sort of all about control with me and domination. But I actually have never properly off my own volition, like pulled apart a novel that I love. I've looked at the schematic of The Silence of the Lambs by Thomas Harris, but I mean, that's a really famous structure that you can find online. And I have used that structure. I've looked at it and went, okay, so it's about 80 scenes and this is where the sort of peaks and troughs are. This is like where the reveals are. And I, you know, that stuff is always kind of in memory. But what I have done is copied stylistic stuff at the sentence level. Like I've typed out pages of Ellroy and David Peace and Jim Thompson and, you know, probably, and Donna Tartt, I've typed a whole chapter of Donna
Tartt. Haven't we all typed out a chapter of Donna Tartt? Who told you to do that? Well, how did you know to do that? Because that's a really kind of like, I remember being asked to do that at RMIT in a writing class, you know, type it out, feel what the words feel like under your fingers, feel like what the rhythm feels like, feel how the sentences are different to your own sentences, that kind of process.
You know, I can't remember where the idea came from, but I do remember doing it. And yeah, this is in recent history, like in the last couple of years. Stephen King's son, I think his name is Joe Hill. I was reading in the newspaper or something, and he was typing out a page of Elmer Leonard every time he sat down, he'd type a chapter of a page of Elmer Leonard, then he'd start his own manuscript. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it's so dirty and crass. Like, I mean, that's literally just inhaling the other work and then sort of exhaling it into your own thing. I was like, well, if this guy is Stephen King's son, you know, Stephen King's, he's got all the advice ever on tap, and yet he's doing it. I'm like, well, I'm not too good for it. And so that's when I started like tooling around with it. Doing it with Donna Tartt is pretty weird. What I found really interesting about it is you can really feel the edits when you do it. Like you write it and you're like, there's no way that this is how it came out of the keyboard. Like this is, you can just, it feels very synthetic compared to how you actually just tap away.
What's it taught you about your process or your language or the way you put sentences together? Is there anything that you shifted sideways after doing that kind of work?
Yeah, like I don't have any training in fiction at all. Like I bring a lot of whatever I have technically has come from academic writing, which is, you know, by no means like readable, legible to anyone. You know,
what you were going to say. I was a bit unsure.
Oh no, it's some of the worst writing ever written by people. And you know, I'm an academic and like I ride for it. It has its place, but. It's terrible writing for the most part. Like as writing, it's bad. It's just bad. And it's like long, it's hard to understand. It's boring and dry. There's reasons for that, very valuable reasons for it. But I think what I got out of it was modulation of like sentence length was a real thing. Like, you know, seeing what the people I aspired to could do with like very short, snippets of language seem really, that sort of opened things up a little bit. And just seeing how unadorned good writing is. Like, again, to go back to Donna Tartt, you think of The Secret History by Donna Tartt as being this ornate jewel of a thing. And then you get into the sentences and there's just nothing there. It's all in this weird tone. It's between the words. Like, there's not huge amounts of adjective or description in there. It just somehow, she just nails it.
She just nails it. Your background in academia is in music. What do you bring over to language and your writing from music?
I'm very inspired and influenced by music in that. And I think what I bring over to it is just the vibe or the aesthetic of the project. Always seems to have a soundtrack or a thing that's in my mind that I'm messing around with. And what I think helps the work sometimes is that it is quite esoteric in terms of what I'm listening to. Like, you know, when I was writing The Spiral, I was listening to Pantera. And not while I was writing, I can't really do that, but I was listening to heaps of this 90s record, Far Beyond Driven by Pantera. Not a good record, and you know, not even really... not an admirable band at all, like full of like deeply problematic people pretty much. And, but you know, there's no one else out there who's trying to like emulate the vibe of Pantera's Far Beyond Driven in there.
There's not. This is your unique point of difference. Ian,
yeah, it is. So, you know, like there's, you know, I think I've said this enough times publicly that if I was going to get sued, I'd probably be sued by now, or the letters of, you know, whatever it'd be in already, but there's a bunch of Pantera lyrics in The Spiral. So they're just dispersed throughout the novel.
And... as a little in-joke to yourself or just to the massive Pantera fan base out there, or?
Kind of, I think it just, actually I wanted to see what would happen. Like, because Pantera seemed like anti-literature. It seemed like a thing that couldn't exist inside any kind of like, thoughtful piece of writing, and yet it did. And then, and what I did learn is that for all of Phil Anselmo's problems, which are varied and many, he's quite a good lyricist. They're like, there's some good lines in there.
You are, as I said in the beginning, an unexpected person, Ian Ryan. You spoke to Jen Bowden for the Margaret River Writers Festival podcast about The Spiral, and you said, the idea of being provocative and confrontational gets me going a bit, which I suppose you've spoken to then. Tell me how that manifests in your books.
Well, first I want to clarify what I mean by that, because I think, I just want to make people... Yeah, I remember listening back to that interview and thinking, oh my God, people are going to think I'm edgy. And I'm not really. I don't want to, that's not actually anything I'm really particularly interested in. I come from music playing that I think people would, most people maybe inside of Australian Letters would not be, they wouldn't have the sort of life experience in music that I would have, and I wouldn't expect them to or even want them to. But yeah, I did things like playing like DIY community hall shows with like a sludge metal band that's got like two bass players and is playing deliberately slow to make, 50 hardcore punks angry, like even more angry, that sort of stuff. Well, my bandmate would get so angry on stage, he'd like kick the wall of the nightclub, like just and breaking stuff and having a very like joyous, but a very odd kind of musical experiences that were in part about not always making the audience entertained or happy. And of course, like I've tried to like remove some of that impulse from my work. I don't write novels like that really. I'm just a bit more comfortable with the fact that people won't always like everything that I'm doing. I don't take it as necessarily a negative response all the time. A bit of polarity in how something is received is probably a good idea.
That's interesting that you draw the analogy to when you were doing stuff, musically as well, because you get such an immediate feedback loop there. Like you understand, you can see your provocation and the impact that it's having, whereas it's so much slower for us when you're putting it out in a book, and then potentially sometimes in the worst of times it goes out there and you don't hear anything. So how do you test whether something is going to be, whether you are pushing it to the edge?
I don't. That was the other thing with the music work, is that people just don't think this way. These are very meager projects. These are records. I probably made 10 records, and at least like half of them were just made in people's houses on equipment that we owned and pressed up ourselves and sold. Some of them are quite sort of successful within their own niches, but there was just no thought whatsoever. Like we would make records and not play it to a single person outside the band. Like it would just exist.
It's just about the process, the actual process of making, of creating the art.
Yeah, and the one thing I did learn from the last band, that crazy sort of heavy metal band, was we made a rule early on that if we wrote the song, we put it out. And we just let... Because we've worked out early in the piece that we weren't actually a very good judge of our own material. And sometimes the audience liked things that we thought were actually a bit much. So... I am I'm relatively comfortable with not knowing and sort of just seeing how things land. I mean, it's different with books, you're right, because you do the thing and then 3 years later or 2 years later,
someone gets upset.
Yeah, you get like this, yeah.
One of the things you said is, I'm not done with a book until I feel a little bit ashamed of it.
The quote that just keeps coming back, it keeps giving. I must have said this like 3 years ago, and it's just... It's that thing. I know it's like this weird meme. It just keeps like every interview, it keeps coming back. And
it's because it's great. It's a great, it's a great line. But also I think there is a level. I've heard people like Keridan Dovey, the writer, talk about the level of shame with her work, and that she's not sure she's done with it until she's ashamed of it. So I think that there's something in there that's really, you've hit on something. You also, in one of the messages that you sent me when you knew that I was reading The Student, and I know I've sent these messages before as well, that kind of half fumbling apology that you do about your own work, where you said, I did try and tone it down. I did try.
So yeah,
I want to know about the measure. I want to know about your, you know, thermometer of shame or whatever it is, and how you position yourself on there while you're writing, and then when you get to the end of a project, and then maybe after as well.
Well, I do try and take out, I've become better over the years at knowing when I've gone too far. But
What is too far, Ian Ryan?
Oh my God, I can't. Well, do you want examples? Like an actual example?
Yes, I do. I want an actual specific example of what is too far.
Okay, so I'm really scared that this is going to be an immense turn off to many listeners, but
let's just cut it out. Let's just go. Dear listeners, the next minute of audio involves some explicit talk if you want to turn down or skip ahead.
So in my first novel, the one that you haven't read, 4 Days, which is out of print at the moment, there is a scene towards the end of the novel where the protagonist goes into this room and it's wallpapered full of pornography because the serial killer is this deranged sort of thing, you know, pretty cliched, except for in this room, they've carpeted the floor with Visqueen PVC. And as he's standing in there, he starts to feel that the flooring is greasy and he looks down and it's like covered in jizz. And he scrambles to get out, but of course he slips and falls and sort of has to like claw his way out. Now, that's what I wrote. And what I published is him just realizing that the floor had jizz on it, not the falling over and rolling around in bodily fluid of the serial killer.
That's an excellent example.
Can we cut that? Can we please cut that?
Yeah, we can cut it if you like. That's a really good example. It's a really good example.
Yeah.
You were saying about when you know you've gone too far.
Yeah. So, yeah, just have a sense of it. And what... you've got to balance it against control. That's how I do it. I balance it against, have I earned it? Have I controlled the narrative in such a way where, you know, where I can do something that feels a bit shameful and a bit like it's a disclosure of like a darker aspect of my own personality, but you know, that I've earned the confidence of the reader because, you know, I've sort of held the book together in such a way. It's a really good example of it in the film Gone Girl. I'm a fan of the novel, Gillian Flynn's novel, but the film Gone Girl by David Fincher, where at the end they have that shower together and she's covered in blood. And again, there's this weird erotic charge to the scene because... she's sort of, they're nude, you see a bit of Ben Affleck's dick, like it all kind of comes together and it's really like noticeably charged. But you know, that's because Fincher's like, you know, has this cold, calculating, controlling thing. So he doesn't just throw you into the bathroom with someone who's covered in blood and naked Ben Affleck. He, you know, really methodically works up to that moment, and and that's kind of why it works. You feel safe to feel those things in that scene.
Are you, when you watch something like that, are you observing that with writerly brain all the time now, and does your writerly brain get in your way sometimes of enjoying or reading or films?
A little. I'm faster now than I used to be. I'm not someone who can... I kind of tend to get sucked into like a film and or a book, but I find that later I'm much faster at like trying to unravel why it worked. Like, so yeah, just talking to my partner after something, I can sort of notice, oh yeah, they did this, this and this to get to this thing. But yeah, I don't suffer too much from, you know, pulling it apart while I'm watching it. Do you?
Sometimes frustratingly, because I pause things and say to my partner, look what they did just there. But not when I'm deeply, deeply sucked in, no. The Spiral has this choose your own adventure aspect in it, and it's terrific. It's slightly, I did message you while I was reading going, what am I supposed to do here? Like, this is really freaking me out. But it's terrific. Can you talk us through how you wrote and structured the novel and incorporated that particular aspect?
It was a leap of faith to a degree. I knew something was going to happen in the middle, and I knew that, you know, I'd already started the sections that had the barbarian in them. So for those who are unfamiliar with the book, There are sections where the protagonist sort of fantasizes about this barbarian from her work, which is on these sort of fantasy choose your own adventure novels. And so I knew something was going to happen. I knew there was going to be a big moment later on in the book that where the barbarian character Cero sort of took over the narrative for like a stretch. Like I knew it was going to be more than just a chapter. It was going to be a good section of the novel. And I started out writing using the aesthetics of the choose your own adventure novels, because that's what Irma, the main character, would have done. And I just was numbering the sections because that's what they look like in the book. And then I got to thinking, well, you know, why am I doing this? And then I thought, oh, well, it really will branch out maybe. But then like, how does that work? Like, then the novel unravels. Then the novel stops being a novel and starts being this branching narrative. Does that mean there's five endings? Or, you know, and I like, no, that was intolerable too, because I knew that what the ending would be. So then over a period of time, I realized what I could do was have it branch out and then come back together into a single linear narrative. And so that section would come apart and then back together. And that also that fit sort of thematically with what the book was sort of dealing with as well.
It's really, it's tricky and enjoyable and kind of just brain melty enough to be frustrating and great. What did your editor say?
They were happy with it, actually. I no one ever talked to me about taking that out or toning it down. Angela did get me to pull back on some of the Cero scenes earlier in the book. Like they were just a bit long. She wanted them to be really, really punchy and short, which is a great edit because, you know, there's definitely a part of the readership that is a bit actively disinterested in them at times. It was wild. I had no real issues with it. I mean, the audiobook was a drama, but, we worked it out. I just rewrote it as one linear thing. And of course, laying it out was a drag. Like, you know, you can imagine how fastidious I sort of had to be to make sure the math of it worked.
Like, I know that you use Scrivener, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Were you doing this in Scrivener or did you have to have a wall plan for this kind of thing?
No, it was all in Scrivener. What I did is I wrote the different branches as linear pieces and then rearranged them, chopped them up and put them into the manuscript. So they printed the manuscript as I wrote it. So I did the work of reassembling it into the different chaotic numbered orders that you need to go back and forward through the section of the book.
Like physically cutting it out?
No, I just did it. Yeah, just did it in Scrivener, actually. Just numbered them up and away I went. It was terrifying.
Utterly, utterly terrifying. I love it.
I'm still convinced to this day someone's going to email me and say, look, this story doesn't end. It just keeps going around in a loop. Like,
okay,
you can't
so
actually
we're
get
waiting on
it.
Two emails for our listeners, first-time listeners. We're waiting to hear from Pantera's,
legal team.
Yeah, and also someone who works out the maths is wrong. Ian, you've got experience with both self-publishing and traditional publishing, and I wanted to ask you about the benefits of both and the pitfalls of both.
Yes, it's sort of trying to think through this. I'm sorry. It's so odd that people talk. No one wants to talk to me about self-publishing ever.
Well, I do.
It's like this dirty. It's like I did the dirtiest thing, and no one wants to talk to me about it.
You did not do a dirty thing. Okay, let's phrase that question again. Okay. Ian, tell me about the dirty self-publishing you did.
Okay, I did it, and I loved it. I loved it. Because I wrote whatever I wanted. And then I published it whenever I wanted to do it in whatever capacity.
Well, where were you publishing?
I was publishing into Amazon exclusively. I think the first book I went wide, Kobo and the other platforms didn't really deliver much in the way of sales. So I went all in on Amazon so I could access their Kindle Unlimited royalty pool. And it didn't do very well. Amazon is a commercial marketplace. It is a step more commercial than the traditional book industry by, I think, quite a long step, in fact. And I just found that my own work, for as much as I enjoyed the process of self-publishing, and you know, the little details and the nitty-gritty of it and the freedom of it, I couldn't make it work as a writer. And yeah, so I didn't exactly come back to traditional publishing with my tail between my legs, because that's insane. I mean, it's such a long shot to even get published, right? It's a privilege. But you know, I really did send the student manuscript to Angela at Echo, because as I was putting together the self-published version of it, I had the cover, everything. I just realized no one was going to buy it on Amazon. Like, it just was going to be a self-published book that quickly sank down the charts and was never heard of again. So I thought, well, there's absolutely nothing to be lost by sending this book out to the one person who had expressed an interest in the past in my work. So with traditional publishing, look, my work is better. You know, I don't think there's any generalizations to be made across the board, but my work is definitely better. It benefits from the editorial assistance of the publisher. It benefits from being forced to take on a big project and land it. I really have to focus on, you don't get a lot of shots. You get one book a year if you're an absolute genius. Many self-publishers are publishing 3 to 4 books a year. So, yeah, I just find that it sort of suits my temperament a bit more. But, you know, I'll probably end up back there.
One of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you is because of this kind of pragmatism and the way that you approach the kind of business of the book as well. And you just kind of demonstrated that then in that conversation. It is time in our conversation to start talking about Taylor Swift, which is what I have promised the people and what continues to be the kind of golden light, other than the dolphin, of my Margaret River experience. You teach music students about lots of things, but partly you teach them about publicity and marketing. Tell us about the Taylor Swift theory, please.
So Taylor Swift is a unicorn, right? She's like a full stack musician. We say, so she's got all of, to use like the coding sort of lands terminology, she's got all of the things you need. She's an immensely talented songwriter in her own aspect. You know, she's completely got that nailed. She looks like Taylor Swift. She's young. She's got all, so that's all locked in. And despite the fact that she had, oh, and she's definitely lucky. Like, this is definitely, you know, this is not a person who's got toxic luck. Despite having all of the advantages that you could pretty much have, you know, she's born in America, she's white. Like, there's all of, you know, all this whole stack of things that she's got going for her that, you know, that people often fixate on. If I just get one of those things right, I'll be okay. No. And she's got them all, and yet, despite the fact that she has them all, her true superpower in this world is that she is able to win people over if she meets them in person. Like, so she can write a great song, she can look like Taylor Swift, and she can be lucky, and she can work hard, no doubt about it. But, you know, that stuff is all kind of levered on top of this idea that she makes people love her if you meet her in person. And it's just it's an interesting thing to talk to the students about, because it just shows that, you know, you do need that sort of unfair advantage, or you need to find that thing that you can do that no one else can do on top of all of the difficult aspects of the creative pursuit that you're involved in. You know, you have to have your craft locked down, and then you have to find the other thing that you can do.
Tell me about when we were discussing this, and I was kind of like had my jaw on the floor and going, tell me everything about this, Ian. Tell me, there's a story that the manager tells about how many people he decided he had to get her in front of.
Yeah, it's like 500,000. So they worked out that if she met, so because she can make people love her when she meets them in person, they, you know, quite rationally, the manager was like, well, we'll just get you in front of 500,000 people, and then they'll buy the record, and that'll get us to number one.
So this is before the first record drops.
I'm not sure, like, the actual timing of this, because she has, like, quite an unusual career. You know, remember, she's in country for a while, and then she breaks out into pop. And I don't know when this happened. I suspect it's around when she made the big break into pop that they really got going on this kind of thinking. And yeah, that's what they did. They went shopping mall to shopping mall in America, and they just went They worked out how many states they had to hit and how many shopping malls they had to go to so that she could meet 500,000 people, and that they would, I think they, you know, they even, the math was, I don't think even that all had to buy the record. They just had to tell a friend or something like that. And yeah, it completely worked. Like, and she's still doing it. She still knows that this is her number one tool in her promotional promotional toolkit.
So what do you want your students come out of that lecture, whatever, that workshop, like me with their jaws on the ground going, yep, okay, how do I be Taylor Swift? What is it that you want them to take away? You want them to try and build an audience? How are they going to go about doing that?
I think the thing I want them to take away is that they just need to find that unique part of themselves that they can do. I mean, it's, you know, and part of it is a bit of a reality check as well. You know, it explains a lot, right? It is very frustrating to be a young, talented person and then realize that you just have to be young, talented, and also extremely good with people, good with sales, good with, you know, hand-to-hand selling. And also, I really do tell them, though, this mainly to emphasize the importance of the face-to-face aspect of it, that really you can build things up quite organically by one relationship at a time, really, and that that face-to-face trumps everything else. Forget, you know, of course, like everyone in the world now, in the West at least, we're all obsessed with metrics and social media. But meanwhile, Taylor Swift is, you know, Skyping people on Christmas Eve, despite being, you know, earning $160 million that year. She's still doing that. So I think that the thing, there's a couple of things to take away from it. Yeah, one is that, you know, that you have to be extraordinarily talented across a huge variety of different skill sets. And the other one is that you should never discount just, you know, trying to make a personal connection with someone in face-to-face.
It's so good. You came to Margaret River Writers and Readers Festivals, and I believe it was your first festival gig as an author. Is this correct?
It was almost my first festival, full stop. I went and saw Willie Vlorton at Melbourne Writers once, but I literally just went to that session and went, oh, well, there's my Willie Vlorton experience. It was wonderful. And then I left.
So as your first face-to-face experience, what was it, what you expected?
No. Oh, my God, no.
Why not?
Because everyone was nice. And you and Chris were like, rat bags. Like, I knew from the moment we were in the car together, I was like, oh my God, I've got this totally wrong. These are music people. Like, they're kind of not, they're not like,
yes, rock stars.
Well, I thought that, so my experience of being around writers and authors, of course, is from academia. And academics can be absolute louche rat bags as well. But, you know, but not, the conferences can be quite stuffy. And particularly if you're at the wrong ones. And I've spent a lot of my career trying to avoid that sort of energy. I'm in popular music studies, which is a much more relaxed discipline. And I was dreading it. I mean, I can tell you now, and because I've said, you know, I've sort of espoused how wonderful it was to people ever since. But yeah, I was absolutely dreading it. I was like, oh God, what have I done? I'm going to like this weird thing across the country where I'll probably catch COVID, and you know, and I'll be in this house with these two people who just want to fucking talk about Proust. Yeah, and I had no idea.
It's absolutely what we did, obviously.
Yeah, it was
entire time. So taking your very clever academic notion of the Taylor Swift theory and then putting it together with your experience of being face-to-face with audiences at a festival, what did you like quickly learn? Because you did a really great job. You were on some panels, and to give background, you know, Ian was programmed in all these kind of crimey sessions. You were the only bloke, I think, on stage a bit.
Yeah, one of them, yeah.
Yeah, so like, how did you navigate your way through that kind of moment of going, I don't want to be here, to, you know, being a minor rock star?
I Like, I really early, I might have even been the first night. No, it was the first day. I got halfway through the first day and I was like, oh, I actually understand what's happening. They've gotten all these people through the door that want to buy books. Like, they've done the hard work for us, right? We're not out on the street with a loudspeaker or handing out flyers. Like, they've gotten all these people in the door and these people are here to buy books and to hear about books. And I was like, this is great. This is a gig. This is, because that's what the gig is. Like, you don't get on stage to play to people who don't want to see your band. They've all bought a ticket. They're already in the building. But, you know, when I go to, like, a book launch, feels, they kind of can feel a bit crappy sometimes. Like, they're not good events. And I've been to readings, like, not readings at the bookstore, which I love, but, like, readings of authors reading their work. And that can be a bit crappy too. They're just not entertaining. They're weird socially sometimes, like awkward. But I immediately recognized that this was like a very, this was like, this model was something I kind of understood. It was like, yeah, it was actually a bit like a music festival where people just paid to get in and then they're just wandering from stage to stage, checking out whatever their friends are checking out.
And that is exactly why it works. And that is why we need more of them and we need them to be funded. There was another thing that I wanted to drag over from your music experience that we talked about in the car. And it was about how you, the kind of work that you do or that you encourage your students to do in an email or in a setup when they're going for a gig and how important it is to do some of that work yourself. Can you just say that better than I just did?
Yeah. So, I mean, when you're getting starting in on music, and I'm sure this is like any other creative pursuit as well, you know, it's terrifying because you love the thing desperately and yet you feel like you are auditioning for a venue, so to speak, like in like the old bar. I'll use the example of the old bar in Fitzroy here. And so you get your band together and you write to the old bar and say, like, basically, can I please have a show? I'll play whatever you want. You know, I'll, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you never hear back from the venues because the venue gets, you know, honestly 5,000 of those emails a week. And, you know, there's not enough money to pay someone to read them all. And what I teach the students to do, and which works, is that you have to start thinking about the other person on the other end of that email and what they actually need to get their life in order, which is that you need to do as much of the work for them as possible. You have to put together the full lineup of all the bands that you want to play. You need to select 3 dates, not any day. And you need to tell them what sort of promotion you're going to do and why people will come to the show. And it doesn't have to be, it needs to be presented as clearly as possible with the cleanest language as possible. No highfalutin adjectives or description of what your band does. Literally, like, you shouldn't even really talk about what your band does other than to say it's this type of music and then a link to listen to the music. And that's how you get it done. So, but the takeaway is you proceed from cautiously from the position of what is the other person on the other end of this email? What, you know, what will make their life easier?
It speaks to me so much because I think that what happens and in the kinds of conversations that we have at writers' festivals and with emerging writers and unpublished writers too is that people want to do a lot of reaching out. And mm-hmm. So they do reaching out to agents or publishers, or they meet agents or publishers and they talk about this project that they haven't quite finished yet. And it's exactly that point there that you're saying you've got to think about the agent or the publisher on the other end who's receiving, you know, hundreds and hundreds of emails and manuscripts a day. And until you have exactly what it is that you want to hand over, you can't make a connection. Then they're never going to pick it up. And you need to make it easy for them. This is what these are the comp titles. This is what my book is. This is, you know, it's exactly the same, but I think that we think about it so differently. We think about it in a very emotional, still very romantic sense about the publishing industry, that someone's just going to pluck your manuscript from the email and make you a superstar, and that's not how it happens.
No, I'm no expert on the publishing industry at all. I mean, you and Catherine have much more experience in this domain, also from the podcast itself. But I mean, there is that pattern of how I interacted with the industry that matches that sort of stuff. Like, I didn't get an agent until I had a contract negotiation in progress. And I thought, oh, I need an agent now, because this is getting a bit too scary.
How did you get that contract negotiation? So you talked before that you had Angela Meyer. You'd sent to Angela Meyer because she'd shown interest in you before. How did that interest, what was that original interest?
So a friend of mine worked at, this is, you know, like through a social connection. A friend of mine worked at Readings and she had dinner with Angela Meyer. Like, I think it was just a completely social sort of thing. And at dinner, Angela's like, oh, look, I need some crime novelists. You know, I want to sign some crime fiction, I suppose, because it sells and Echo is trying to establish itself in Australia. I don't know, you'd have to ask Angela. But and so I sent her 4 Days, which had been published in the US, and she read it and she's like, it's too rough. and it was also 30,000 words. But, you know, send me something else in the future. And then, yeah, I sort of followed it up with that next novel. And then I just did the whole, that contract was all, I just hired someone to look at the contract for me. But then it was the next one when Bonnie and Zaffa, the UK people, started coming involved as well. And I was in the middle of, my partner was about to have a baby. We're like 1 month away from having the baby. So I was just literally losing my mind. I'm like, I think it was actually my partner, Claire, who told me, she's like, there's people whose job it is to do this. Just please get an agent. I don't want to talk about it anymore. And I'm like, oh, it's, I think it's hard to get an agent, babe.
Did you do it?
Oh, I'm not going to name the person who told me how to do it, but another Australian author of literary fiction, which isn't you, told me how to work out the names and email addresses of people who worked at literary agency Curtis Brown. And I sent 2 cold emails and I think I probably had the agent within like 2 days. But I mean, I was approaching them saying, look, it's just free money here. Can you come in and just talk to me about it? And they, yeah.
There's so much to take away from our conversation, Ian Ryan. You have a proper job as an academic. You also have 2 children. So that baby that was about to be born went on to be born. You have 2 children. How does your writing get done? Where do you do it? How do you do it? What gives in your life to make it happen?
So I do it here in the office that I'm talking to you in, which is my office at RMIT. And I do it before work. So I come in really early and I sort of bang out a couple of 100 words before work starts, and which is great because I'm from Queensland. And in Queensland, you go out on the street at 7:30 in the morning and the streets are full in the CBD. People are going around getting their coffees, having smokes. It's like the streets are just full of people. You come down here at 7:30 and it's like 4:30 in Queensland. So, you know, I get in and I work for, you know, maybe up to 90 minutes or something before I see the first person in my building. So that's how I get it done. And in terms of like what gives, I don't really play music much anymore. That's sort of gone by the wayside a little bit. But to be honest, like I try and keep it out of my family's way. I really, you know, worry too much about, you know, what I could have achieved in my life for my family had I not written novels. And this is very common, especially, you know, I suppose I spend more time talking to dads at playground than moms, but like some of the other dads, like I know, I was talking to a comedian the other day, he had exactly the same. He's like, if I'd just not done comedy, or if I'd put this energy into being, you know, a property analyst, I could have, you know, we wouldn't be living here. I wouldn't be renting my house and, you know, things like that. And I've had the same misgivings, but yeah. And with that in mind, I just try and keep it out of my partner's way as much as possible.
It's refreshing to hear. And it is also absolutely part of my gig because women, we don't actually mostly ask the women that we interview about how they work around their kids, but I make it my point to ask the men. I'm going to ask you advice and I'm going to ask you 2 bits of advice. I've already mentioned that we had a couple of extended car trips together. And when I wasn't asking you about the rules of crime writing or the Taylor Swift theory, et cetera, I was also probably giving a lot of advice because I tend to do that. I give a lot of advice whether people want it or not. I'm trying to get a little bit better at holding back. So, but there was at least one moment in the car where I was like, shit, is Ian taking notes? Is he noting notes? So I want to know, so that I can just try and share one piece of advice with people from now on, what was the most useful advice that I gave you?
You know, I'm not sure I can, I'll think let me talk and I'll hopefully get to the one piece of advice. I just want to say that first off, they were like, those two car rides are like hands down the most I've ever learnt about publishing in Australia, like the entire time I've been doing it.
It's like a master's by car ride.
It really was. And like, I was like, you know, these were the conversations that I thought I would have with my editors and my agents and my publicists and things like this. And no one, what you learn is no one talks to the author about anything ever. It's just, you're always kind of in the dark a little bit, even when everyone is being nice and competent and getting behind you, as I've had been wonderful support from my publishers and the people in the industry, but no one really talks to you. Like, people ask writers all the time, like, so how's the book selling? And the truth is always like, I don't know. I got no idea how it's going. Ask me in 8 months when I see the return. If I see the return. Yeah, I mean, you know that if you're a bestseller, because someone will probably give you a phone call, I imagine. But up until that point, it's just zero. Just zero to 10,000 copies. So, you know, not having spent... I realize I know a lot of writers, but I haven't spent much time at all around people who are in the commercial parts of trade publishing in fiction. Like, people who were like, you know what, kind of wouldn't mind making a go of it. And I am proud of my work, and I want to do the best I can by it. And so I think, like, more so than any particular piece of advice, like, it was just your vibe that I was like, oh yeah, I'm down. This person is like really got their hustle together, and it's not just about stepping on other people. It's not about being smarter or more literate than anyone else or better read. It's just about getting out there and putting like a approachable face on the book.
And thank you very much for that, Ian Ryan. That's obviously why I got you on the show, just to say such lovely things about me. All right. So now I want your piece of advice. And I also know, because I've listened enough, that you are not allowed to answer stay hydrated because you've already used that gag. So you can't answer that. But I want to know your advice for an author, you know, who's coming up behind you, or maybe something that you wish you'd known earlier, or the thing that you kind of remind yourself every day.
Well, for me, things have always gotten better for me when I've done the wrong thing. You know, all the ideas that I had about when I meant to write a novel, everything got easier and better, the work included, when I did the things that I thought were the wrong things to do. So my first couple of novels, I'm writing them like an artist, and I'm just pounding away, oh, la, 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 la. You know, here's 15 story loops, and I don't close any of them, and then it's got a downbeat ending or whatever. Outlining. You know, plan the thing before I do. Don't get romantic. Get unromantic would be my piece of advice. Copy the work of other people. Don't worry about stealing someone else's style. You'll never get it 100% right. So who cares? Write in genres. You know, my early work is something like literary fiction, and it's all garbage. But when I got to genres, I need it. I need the constraints.
I love that advice. Be unromantic. That is what we will do going forward. Before I let you go, do you have a debut recommendation of a book? It doesn't have to be a novel, any time, any genre.
I joked that I was going to say the Bible, didn't I? I'll go for a single author like manuscript instead of, you know, that sort of that edited collection, so to speak. I'll go back to The Secret History. I mean, I kind of blew the punchline a bit by talking about it so much earlier in the episode. But yeah, that's definitely my favorite debut novel. And I find it endlessly interesting. I've read it a number of times now. I think it's a great crime novel. I think it doesn't get enough props for actually being a crime novel. Structurally, super interesting in how she kind of gets around some of the tropes of crime fiction, and a very encouraging backstory too, because I think the popular misconception is that she pretty much writes it at university and that she comes out and she's this glorious young author, and yeah, she's young, but she's also 28. She's 6 years after graduating from Bennington alongside, you know, Bret Easton Ellis and all these other kind of contemporaries. She's had a great education and then spent most of her life up until that point working on the novel. And then it, you know, it was a raging success, but I just, it doesn't to me look that easy. Like, I don't think of it as like, oh, she just kind of pooped out this wonderful novel. No, like, she worked for it, and she was by all accounts brilliant, you know, on top of that.
Damn her and her brilliance. But I'm so glad that you raised that book, and I'm so glad to have talked to you officially. We may have to cut a couple of bits out because probably, you know, it's not all appropriate, but I'm very, very glad that we got long car trips together, and I'm very, very glad to now know all of these new things, including the Taylor Swift theory. And I hope that many people now go out and read your books, The Student and The Spiral.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.